Welcome to Cassandra Explains It All, a podcast where we take a magnifying glass to all of our treasures from the past.
Okay, perfect. So what you guys are about to hear is Drew Barrymore, Little Girl Lost. I have been reading this very elusive memoir over on my Patreon. We are up to chapter 5. So I'm going to put a little bit of it here on the main feed. So if you guys like it, you can come over to the Patreon, join, and you can hear the entire book. Like I said, we are up to chapter 5. And it's really getting juicy. So I will see you guys there later. Okay, perfect. So today is a very special episode. We are going to start digging into the Drew Barrymore book, Little Girl Lost. I've got it sitting here. I literally just took it out of the bubble wrap that I keep it in. It's a precious artifact that I need to protect because there are only probably 4 left of these online that you can purchase. I debated a little bit about, as I was going through reading the book, if I should like add audio clips for you guys of different interviews of Drew and people that knew her, but I kind of wanted to give you just the experience of hearing the book like an audiobook and just read through it cover to cover. No interruptions. So hopefully that's what you guys want. I hope you guys are ready. Get your popcorn, get your pumpkin spice latte, get your iced coffee, get your tea, get whatever you need because this is such a treat, you guys. Obviously, I'm posting pictures of the cover and I will post pictures of the book as we go through this as well, just because I want everybody, you know, to get the full idea of what it looks like and be able to see the pictures that she included and everything like that. Little Girl Lost, the stunning New York Times bestseller. Little Girl Lost did disappear slowly over the years, and you know, there were interviews done with Drew about the book when it first came out, and I think that that's gonna have to just be a total aside episode by itself, talking about the lore of this book, because I'm just ready to get into it. It was first published in January of 1990. I have the paperback version and it is 304 pages. Drew Barrymore with Todd Gold. A child star's descent into addiction and out again. Little Girl Lost, the stunning New York Times bestseller. When you open the book, it says, Drew Barrymore, the granddaughter of movie legend John Barrymore, won a place in the hearts of film audiences at age 6, playing the impish little sister Gertie in the blockbuster E.T., the Extraterrestrial. She had since co-starred in Irreconcilable Differences, Firestarter, Cat's Eye, and See You in the Morning. Todd Gold is a staff correspondent for People magazine. He maintains a distinctly un-Hollywood lifestyle in California with his wife and 2 children. 2, Mom, Jan, David, Beth, Betty, Lori, Dallas, and my father. Acknowledgements. Beth, everlasting partnership in love. JJ, thank you. L, for giving me the most valuable lessons and friendship. Betty, I'd be lost without you. Lori, you're indescribably the best. Dallas, you mean everything. I'm glad you kept me in line. Jan, I love you more than words could ever describe. David, I would have to write another book to express to you my love and thanks. Mikey, you're really the best friend. Anthony, please believe me, you're wonderful. Angie, cup of noodles, kisses, hugs, and I love you forever. Christine, to crazy nights and beautiful friendship. Cindy, the loud birthday cakes and funky times. Jimmy, to the most beautiful relationship and bananas. I love you always. Stephen, I love you for everything. Todd, thank you for giving me a great ground to stand on and believing in me. To Mom, through good and bad, pain and relief, life and death, sun and rain, there will always be us. I love you for everything, the mistakes we both made. We're coming out beautifully. I love you forever and ongoing, everlasting support. Prologue. Over the past year and a half, numerous stories about my battle against drug and alcohol addiction have appeared in magazines, newspapers, and tabloids. None of them was flattering, and few of them were kind in the way that someone who needs help might appreciate. More important, none of them offered a complete picture of how I lived the past 14 years, and that by itself is an important part of understanding the problems I've had to face. When I began working on this book in late winter 1988, I was but a few months out of rehab and still undergoing intense outpatient therapy. I was excited to be free in the world again and be able to tell the happy story of my recovery. I enjoyed thinking about how this book would end in a tidy scene of my being completely cured, waltzing away from my problems, and satisfied I had proved all the doubters and cynics of gossip columns wrong about my chances for a happy, natural life. It was as if I'd gone through rehab for them, just to prove them wrong. Unfortunately, while completing this book, I found myself writing one thing and living another. I suffered a relapse. Scared and embarrassed, I kept it to myself until it was impossible to hide. And by that time, it was nearly too late. The temptation in recovery is to believe that once rehab is finished, you will be completely healed. The reality, as I found, is quite the opposite. The truth is that you are never fully mended. You just learn how to deal with the problems that intensify your disease. That's what I discovered, and I believe the conflict between illusion and reality is accurately reflected in these pages. It surprised me, I have to admit, I had fervently hoped for a nice upbeat ending with no loose ends like in the movies, an ending that would leave me feeling quite the heroine. I really believed it was what I deserved. Instead, I found myself adding two chapters of a different tone from the rest of the book while in the final weeks of another stay in rehab. In place of the happy fantasy I intended as the ending, what I wrote is a truthful one and a realistic one to anyone who is or knows a recovering addict alcoholic. There is no happy ending because there is no end to the struggle for a clean and sober life. The happiness comes from knowing that you're alive and you have a fighting chance to enjoy it. As of writing this, I'm in the final weeks of rehab. My last time in the hospital, I hope. And I'm just looking ahead to the start of school, making movies, and just being honest with myself. First page, Little Girl Lost. Chapter 1, Headlines. It was the best time of my life. I can't underestimate it. Making E.T. the extraterrestrial was the most wonderful experience any actor could ever wish for. Just imagine a little wide-eyed, giggly kid in pigtails making that movie, and you get a sense of what it was like for me. I was a six-year-old girl who always preferred make-believe and fantasy and playing dress-up to reality. Anything where I could lose myself in another character. And then I was introduced to this wonderful, cute, wrinkled creature named E.T. I fell in love. To me, E.T. was extremely real. Yes. I knew he was something Steven Spielberg created, but I actually believed in him. I could touch him, hug him, kiss him. He put his arms around me. From the moment I saw him, E.T. instantly became my best friend. On lunch breaks, I used to take my food into the room where he was kept, sit down beside him, and carry on a conversation while I ate. I talked to him about my mother and where we lived. If it was cold outside, I wrapped a scarf around his neck. I was always excited to be with him. Occasionally, some of the older crew members sat down with us and tried speaking to E.T. When he didn't answer, they asked, "How come he talked to me and not to them?" "He's very shy," I explained in my most serious little girl voice. "And I think he prefers talking to kids." One day, when filming was near completion, I got very sad and depressed, which was the opposite of my usual lighthearted and laughing self on set. Steven asked what was bothering me, and I told him that I dreaded having to say goodbye to E.T. Who would ever want to lose a friend like him? But Steven understood. He told me that I could visit him whenever I wanted. That was exactly what I wanted to hear. Letting out a cry of delight and grinning from ear to ear, I ran over to E.T., wrapped my arms around him, and planted a big kiss on his rubbery cheek. Like I said, it was the best time in my life. But the turnaround was dramatic. In the final days of December 1988, Drew was experiencing the worst time in her life. She had spent the past 6 months undergoing intensive rehabilitation treatment for a four-year addiction to alcohol and drugs. An addiction that had turned her into a bloated and bruised remnant of her public image. That whole enterprise had been hellish enough. to make Drew think she'd been through everything life could possibly throw her way. However, on the eve of her long-anticipated pre-Christmas discharge from the ASAP Family Treatment Center, the private drug and alcohol hospital where she had been residing off and on since early summer, Drew and her mother, Jade Barrymore, were delivered a startling jolt of bad news. The gossipy tabloid National Enquirer was about to blow the lid off her tightly guarded secret, whether or not she approved. Drew's struggle with booze and drugs was about to be made public. There was serious concern among those close to her about the effect such a shocking revelation would have on Drew, who, at 13 years old, was re-entering the world as fragile as a baby doe learning to walk on wobbly legs. My mental state at that point was delicate and raw. Excited to go home, I was struggling to digest everything I'd been dealing with in treatment. I'd been learning how to manage again in the outside world. I'd finally gotten reacquainted with myself after years of masquerading as someone else. It was a lot to contend with. The prospect of stepping beyond the safety of the hospital was frightening enough by itself. I didn't need to be worrying about gossip columns magnifying and distorting the difficulties I'd been trying to overcome. Needless to say, I was furious. While everyone else, including my mother, my therapists, grew dizzy from concern, I erupted into a rage, a huge, horrible, angry outrage that evidenced the dark and temperamental side I inherited from my Barrymore ancestors. It seemed to vent my frustration some, and then I cried. I cried so hard I found myself huddled in bed, trembling uncontrollably. A low self-esteem had plagued me for years, almost as far back as I can recall, and repairing it had been a major part of my treatment at ASAP. Consequently, imagining the god-awful headlines, Drew Barrymore, cocaine addict at 12 years old, or Barrymore burns out in teens, the impression that people would get of me was all my worst possible fears come true. I would have been the last person on earth to deny my problems, but I wanted to have the option of confessing them. In the position I found myself, I felt helpless, like a drowning swimmer gasping for air. I didn't know what to do, and I fell into the worst depression. In the years since making ET, Drew had matured into a stunning teenage beauty, who, by all accounts, had grown up much too fast for her own good. 6 years and more than $700 million in box office receipts has passed since Drew playing the effervescent Gertie nearly stole scene after scene from the lovable alien in what became the most successful movie and video in history. Yet the downcast teenager who sat on a hospital cot pondering an invasion of her privacy bore only scant resemblance to the winsome child who had charmed audiences with her wide eyes and ear-splitting scream. Drew's innocence had vanished along with her youth. In June, she had been admitted to the ASAP hospital after an all-night drunken binge left her ill and babbling incoherently. 3 months later, she was readmitted to the hospital after a two-day cross-country jaunt fueled by cocaine, alcohol, and a credit card taken without permission from her mother. On the threshold of her release from rehab, Drew was only beginning the lifelong process of recovery. She clearly recognized what she had previously chosen to ignore, that her consumption of drugs and alcohol was in inverse proportion to her ability to handle them. However, if she was to remain sober like any addict, she had to go beyond simply identifying the obvious symptoms of her sickness: hangovers, irritability, constant fighting with her mother. Drew had to address and solve the underlying issues that cause her addiction, what the crux of treatment had been all about. In retrospect, entering the hospital and confronting my problems was a matter of life and death. There's no underestimating that. For years, I was so busy trying to mask the pain and fear that I always kept hidden from myself as well as from everyone else, that I became a stranger to myself and my own worst enemy. Stuck on a one-way avenue towards self-destruction, I have no doubt that I was writing my own obituary. I had to break out of the pattern of behavior. I had to accept that I was an addict, alcoholic, and that proved the most difficult challenge I ever had to confront. But the most frightening aspect of the whole process was facing myself. When I entered the hospital, I couldn't even sit in a room alone.
The person I'd become was no one I wanted to hang around with. I had built a wall around me so thick and so high that even I couldn't penetrate it. Of course, I didn't really want to. On the outside, I was this tough girl who thought she could handle anything. Boy, was I deluding myself, though. In truth, I was anything but that well-adapted character. Actually, I was this vulnerable little child, bruised and tender on the inside, a kid who refused to acknowledge the tremendous pain that had built up and been ignored over time. In a bit of twisted logic, I deal with that reality by not dealing with it. I numbed myself with alcohol and drugs. As a girl, I once entertained thoughts of becoming a construction worker. I had this image of myself walk along the iron girders of a high-rise building, performing my tasks without regard for the danger of being 20 floors above the ground. But acting was like that too, exciting, and I craved the work I got in the films Firestarter, Cat's Eye, Irreconcilable Differences, and See You in the Morning. Acting is all I've ever thought of doing. It's something I've been inexplicably drawn to by enthusiasm and ambition. However, what I never admitted, not even to myself, is that my desperate need to perform was fed by a deep-seated insecurity of low self-esteem. I hungered for the love and affirmation I felt was absent from my life. It was my private wound, a wound that festered and grew over the years. Yet, stardom has always been a role which I never really accepted. It's never seemed real, like anything I could identify, and yet fame is something that has to be dealt with. I've always grappled with the clash of images versus reality. The public saw me as Drew Barrymore, movie star, while I viewed myself quite differently. As a sad, lonely, and unattractive girl with not much to her advantage, fame changed everything so suddenly. Virtually overnight, everybody knew me, and yet nobody knew me. I mean, the real me. From early on, I was always this remote, dreamy little girl who loved escaping reality by acting in movies. I desired the attention and recognition as much as I liked becoming a different character. Without work, I believed, I was nothing. I was horribly insecure. It wasn't what anyone imagined me. Drew Barrymore, the celebrated actress and heir to the great Barrymore legacy, to be like. I was supposed to be, as Steven Spielberg once told reporters, this perfect 7-year-old going on a mature 29, and that's the way I behaved. I always felt as if I had to live up to such incredibly high expectations. It was hard on me emotionally, and I believe I made people think I was someone who I wasn't. I'd walk into a restaurant or some room where there were other kids and sense that everyone was looking at me thinking, I'm sure she's the biggest snob or brat on earth. But I wasn't. I was really this frail little thing who wanted to shout, hey, I didn't want to be famous. I just want to be loved. I'm scared. I don't know how to deal with this. Growing up an only child raised by a single working mother, I was riddled by insecurity, always fearing that people wouldn't like me. How could they? I thought. My father hates me. My mother likes me only for the money I earn. And I know for damn sure that I'm nothing but a worthless piece of flesh. As I got older, the problems magnified, and it became harder and harder for me to deal with them, especially between projects. Without the ego boost of work, I got into trouble with liquor and drugs by trying to run from everything, or to numb it. I was the party girl on the run. If I was high, I thought everything was fine. The trouble was that I had to be high all the time. By the time I got into rehab, my life was completely out of control. Everything was just so screwed up and so off kilter, and I couldn't handle my life. On the surface, people might blame Hollywood for my troubles. It would be easy to cast me as a fast lane victim of the glitter and glamour, but that's not remotely close to the truth. If anything, work was my saving grace. The one tangible thing I could always rely on to boost my sagging self-esteem and confidence. My problems had more to do with life in general, the family I was born into, the home in which I was raised, the times I live in. It's just so hard being a teenager today. And that's what pissed me off so much about the National Enquirer thing. It was just so shallow and distorted. Nowhere is perception more clouded by illusion than in Hollywood, the place that made Drew the most loved child star since Shirley Temple. She became a fifth-generation actor and celebrity in a family whose name figured prominently in entertainment circles, going as far back as England's George III. To the public, she was a charmed cutie doll, a pint-sized prodigy living out a fairy tale existence. As she grew, was photographed smiling, frolicking at play. As far as the public was concerned, she had money, fame, and attention. Problems? Not Drew. She was, after all, a Barrymore. But that alone should have been clue enough to a more unsettling reality. For if acting was a part of the Barrymore legacy, so too was the pall of tragedy. Drew's grandfather, John Barrymore, one of the finest Shakespearean and movie actors of the 1920s and 30s, drank himself to death at age 60. Aunt Diana Barrymore admitted herself destructive hunger for booze and drugs in the 1957 bestseller Too Much Too Soon. Likewise, Drew's own father, John Drew Barrymore, whom by the time of her hospitalization she hadn't seen in 7 years, had a lengthy history of alcohol and drug-related problems. Given her tender age, there was little reason to suspect Drew would also succumb to the dark Barrymore destiny. As far as anyone imagined, she appeared to be a sweet, lovable scamp, radiating easy smiles and infectious giggles, and brimming with the endless possibilities of youth. The insidious demons that plagued her family seemed to have mercifully skipped a generation. Yet, unbeknown to anyone, Drew's precious movie stardom was accompanied by a more shocking precocity off-screen, a premature appetite for drinking and drugs. I started smoking cigarettes when I was 9 and a half. I was smoking constantly, going out and doing everything I could to be bad. It wasn't long before I began thinking, well, if I can smoke cigarettes, I can drink. It was an easy step, one that I didn't take alone. I started drinking with friends when I slept over at their houses, just sneaking a drink here and a beer there. After a while, though, drinking became the only way I thought I could have fun. Only, I didn't drink to have fun, I drank to get drunk. I was also a club hopper at 10, as much as someone that age can be. I would sleep over at friends' houses and we would sneak out. One time a magazine ran a picture of me dancing and a headline that said, "Drew Barrymore dancing at 2 a.m. Shouldn't she be in bed? Maybe other kids that age should have been in bed, but that wasn't for me. I didn't care what anyone thought. I was accepted in the club world. I felt I belonged and I wanted to be there. After a while, though, I started thinking, well, this is getting boring now, so let's try something even better. If I can drink, I can smoke pot. There's nothing to it. When I was 10 and a half, I was sitting in the back seat of a car driven by my friend's mother. She started smoking pot. I'd wanted to try marijuana for a long time, but I was afraid that if I asked, she'd say, "No way, Drew, you're too young." However, she offered me some, and I said, "Sure, I'll try it." I was shocked, but she had a look that seemed to say, "Isn't it cute, a little girl getting stoned?" Eventually, that got boring too, and my addict mind told me, well, if smoking pot is cute, it's also cute to get into the heavier stuff like cocaine. My usage was gradual, but what I did kept getting worse and worse, and I didn't care what anybody else thought about me. The higher I got, the happier I imagined myself, the more miserable I actually was. The pattern fit. Friends have always described me as the obsessive and compulsive. And in the hospital, I learned that an addict is nothing but someone who compulsively pursues self-destructive behavior. My whole life became geared towards satisfying my addiction. In my case, it was a means to overcome great insecurities. Someone once explained to me what the word veneer meant. Gloss, a shiny surface that's supposed to protect an interior material underneath. That's me exactly. Whenever I'd look in the mirror, I'd think, "You're lost, totally lost. How can anyone like you? You don't even like yourself." Those moments when I realized how estranged I'd become from myself, not to mention the rest of the world, sent me spiraling into a depression. And my depressions knew no depths. Imagine being trapped in a descending elevator that never hit the ground floor. You get to a point where you'll do anything to get out.
With her December release from ASAP imminent, Drew could look back upon her 6 months in the hospital and see how mistaken she was about her own condition when first admitted in June. Back then, in her own mind, she was the worst case scenario. No one could possibly have sunk to such depths, she thought. Now, Drew could see how wrong she was. However, it had taken quite a while in rehab before she arrived at an important realization. She wasn't the worst case, not even close. In fact, Drew discovered her drinking and drug use were actually more common among people her age, teenagers, than she'd ever imagined. In ASAP's multifamily sessions, frank discussion groups that brought together parents and their children, the frightening fact of rampant substance abuse was etched on the face of nearly every adult. Over time, warnings from experts have gone virtually unheard, drowned amid the cacophony of the crime and violence that permeate society. But drug use and alcoholism among the young has been rising for years. The problem, experts say, has surpassed epidemic proportions. Surveys have shown that somewhere between 30 and 40% of adolescents nationwide use drugs every weekend, and according to the National Council of Alcoholism, the percent of students using drugs prior to sixth grade has tripled since 1975. When she thought about it, Drew concluded that she was way out of line thinking she was worse than everyone else. Her circumstance was dire. That was true, but her problems made her far more average than she ever dreamed. Average, that was a hoot. The word ingrained itself in Drew's mind. Average was all she had ever wanted to be. It was also the last way she pictured herself. She based that on innocent observations. Her friends she saw all had mothers and fathers, siblings, and seemingly happy homes. Compared to them, Drew thought of her own life as empty, depressing, and bereft of laughter and familial warmth she tried so desperately to absorb when visiting her playmates. That's what gave acting its importance, the ensemble feeling that arose from being a part of a production crew, the approval won from good work. It all fulfilled a desperate emotional need. Unfortunately, Drew learned these rewards were temporary. The end of the film always proved traumatic. She'd get close to people, they'd be yanked away, and had to go back home, which sent her spiraling into a depression. Early on, Drew learned not to count on her father, a volatile man of unpredictable personality, who seemed determined to make her life miserable every time she saw him. And her mother, a part-time actress, worked so many jobs to make ends meet that Drew grew up feeling abandoned and starved for affection. There were times when Drew would have gladly and quickly traded all of her acclaim for acting to be more like her pals at school. When I looked out the window, I saw that everyone's situation was better than mine. I was sure of it. Their dads would drive off to work in their sports cars, and their moms would stay home and bake cookies and pick up their kids at school in their station wagons. It was the total suburban dream lifestyle. The kind of place where Steven Spielberg sets his films. My life, it appeared, was directly opposite that. I'd ride along with my friends in their carpools, listening to their mothers talk about family business, and then they'd come to my house. I'd get dropped off and run inside to my babysitter. Our house seemed so empty and quiet and lonely. My mom was off working and my dad was out of his mind. One time, a friend asked why my father didn't live at home with us. "Because," I replied, "when he's here, he beats the living daylights out of us." I loved the book A Wrinkle in Time and read it over and over. In one part, there's a description of a neighborhood that I believed paralleled my life. The neighborhood is fashioned by a row of houses, all identical in shape and size, and all the children who live in them dress alike, do the same things, and have the exact same experiences. And then there is one oddball house that is completely different. The people who live there stand out like a sore thumb. I felt as if I came from that different house. Anyway, that's how I saw my life. I always wanted to know why I couldn't be like one of the identical from one of the identical houses on the block, and why I was always trying so hard to make my life like the book. As Drew's discharge date from ASAP neared, one of the things she looked forward to most was being able to sleep late in the morning. That was enough of a Christmas present. throughout her hospitalization, she was awakened each day at 7:30 a.m. by a staff member who knew enough of her bleary-eyed growls to be wary. Her two roommates were equally ornery at that early hour. But that was life at the hospital, lots of rules and routine, their cramped room far from the ornate boudoir one might expect of a famous young actress, was stocked with the bare essentials of dorm life, beds, a dresser, and a bathroom. Pictures of good-looking guys, hunks ripped from magazines, adorned the otherwise plain stucco walls. In the midst of shared grumbles, Drew dressed quickly. Like the others, it had taken Drew a while to get used to the rigidly circumscribed days and nights of rehab. After so many months, of course, it was all second nature. Following wake-up, she straightened her cot, tucking in blankets and propping her favorite stuffed bear beside the pillow. An ironic reminder of girlhood. Drew took breakfast, usually a cup of black coffee, on the run, then headed for the hospital's classroom, where she attended school from 9 till 12. Lunch and dinner were both followed by a myriad of therapy sessions, individual, group, and family therapy, and multifamily meetings. The ensuing emotional confrontations, more like purges, were grueling, torturous ordeals. On an average day, she went through an entire box of tissues. When I first arrived at the hospital, I was extremely standoffish, the most distant, obstinate person in the entire hospital. People asked me a million questions, and I wouldn't answer them. I just sat in various groups, twirling the ends of my hair around my fingers, letting whatever anyone said drift in one ear and out the other. Nor did I participate in any of the discussions. I wasn't going to admit that I had any problems. No way. That meant facing up to everything that I've been running from. Yet the pressure building inside me was enormous. The emotions I worked so hard to suppress were straining to get out, pushing against the seams of my consciousness. It was the program starting to work, whether or not I wanted to admit it, which I didn't. The various therapies were affecting me. I didn't want to acknowledge that, though. All I wanted to do was drink my coffee, smoke my cigarettes, and get the hell out of there. Just do my time and be out with my friends. That was my frame of mind. Then one afternoon in the cafeteria during lunch, I overheard these two older girls talking about how messed up they were before they came into the hospital. I thought that was bad, but as I listened, I realized they were in a lot deeper than me. They'd been doing lots of cocaine, speed, anything they could get their hands on. They experimented with different drugs like acid and pills and stole from their parents' medicine cabinet. One of them had even been arrested for stealing a car radio. "What do you do?" one of them asked me. I told her about my two-day drug-induced romp from New York to Los Angeles. "Yeah?" she raised her eyebrows. "Well, I've heard worse." "You have?" I said, surprised. "You bet. Everyone has. You just got here, but you'll see. You come in thinking you're the worst piece of shit here, but you'll learn different. We're all the same. Screwed up kids with screwed up parents living in a screwed up world." I smiled. "You scared?" she asked. "Yeah," I nodded. I was too at first. You think a rehab hospital is like one of those gruesome prisons like in the movie Midnight Express, but it's not. This is a bad place, but in a good way, if that makes any sense. It made sense. By the end of December, it made lots of sense. Drew didn't want to conceal anything from anyone. She knew well the dangers of that. Drew had used her ample talent as an actress to conceal her addiction from her mother. She turned on Drew Barrymore, actress, smiling, sweet, laying on the saccharine coating heavy and thick, and for a long while that got her by. "Like most parents of kids with drug and alcohol problems, I had no idea what was going on," says Drew's mother, Jade. "People want to know where I was when all of this was going on, but the question, though obvious, is still somewhat of a shock, since our lives have always been so closely intertwined. Perhaps too close. Jade, as a single parent, had always tried to be everything and more to Drew. Mother, father, best friend, confidant, and gopher. She'd turned herself into supermom, always running and doing and huffing and puffing from the weighty responsibilities she'd assumed to ensure her daughter the finest life they could afford. From day one, Jade vowed that Drew would never lack a thing if it was within her means to provide it. Clothes, the best schools, the choicest film roles. She did so many things to show Drew that she was loved. If she grew up with tunnel vision, Jade says, then it's my fault. However, in the end, nothing seemed to matter. Drugs and alcohol changed Drew, exercising infinitely more power and influence than her mother ever could. Jade, like many other parents, missed the warning signals. The signs were almost lifted from a textbook. Listless, poor schoolwork, dishonesty, a change in friends, personality swings. It even got to the point where Drew refused goodnight kisses to avoid scrutiny of her breath. In retrospect, you kick yourself for not noticing, Jade said, but you chalk it up to growing pains. You never think my kid is doing drugs. If it was any consolation, which it later was, Jade wasn't alone in failing to recognize her child's addiction. It can be a difficult thing to see. Addicts, instead of admitting they've lost control, spin ever more complicated webs of lies and alibis to cover up their problems. And those people who are closest to them often find themselves unwitting codependents to the addiction. They're often so involved that they don't or can't recognize the problem until it's too late. The relationship is nearly as dangerous as the addiction itself. Before rehab, the lines of our relationship were fuzzy. When I was little, my mother worked night and day so that she could afford to give me whatever I wanted. Left with a babysitter most of the time, I felt abandoned. Later, as my career heated up, she quit her job and became my manager. That just confused everything even more. Not only did I harbor a long-standing anger toward her for abandoning me, but I also imagined that my primary worth to her was the money I earned. I was wrong, of course. It was a fabrication on my part, but I couldn't see or was too selfish to see that she loved me and had only my best interests at heart. These issues weren't ever confronted, and over time, our relationship disintegrated to where I didn't want anything to do with her. Not because I didn't love her, that wasn't it. It was more that my mom bore the brunt of the unhappiness I felt towards myself. The angrier I was at myself, the angrier, nastier, and meaner I was to her. She'd react in ways that only fed the inferno of my temper, and our problems escalated from there. It's funny. I never would have treated a friend that way, but she was my mother. I knew that no matter what I did or said, she'd come back, hoping for a change of heart. It got to the point where I'd reduce her to tears. I love you, she'd plead. Why are you doing this to me? To us? I didn't know what to say. Of course, when I needed a shoulder to cry on, I went to her. Me playing the great manipulator. But the minute my tears went away, so did I. I vanished quicker than you can say Houdini. She'd want to get close, and I'd ignore her. It was like, see ya, I've got better things to do. Life was a circle of vicious confrontations and evasions. I'd put on this nonchalantly sweet act whenever I was around my mom. It was all fake, though. I didn't want her to know how much pain and trouble I was in. If she found out about my using, she'd find a way to stop the only thing that I believe made my life bearable. Besides, it was easier to blame her for all of my problems. If she was mad at me, well, that proved what a jerk I was. Which was reason enough to get loaded. But that whole time, I knew inside that I truly did love my mother. I wanted to change. I wanted to have a relationship. I just didn't know how. Thanks to me, she forgot as well. I'd gone too far over the edge. I didn't even know how to say I love you without acting. That was scary. In the hospital, I learned to confront my fears. I had to recognize them, write them down, articulate them, explain them to others, and then figure out how to work through them. Nothing was sacred. The process makes you feel like a punching bag being pummeled by an unrelenting Mike Tyson. It's draining, exhausting, and painful, but it works. In late October, E.T. was finally released on home video amid much hype. I wasn't aware of the event. However, one night, I was eating dinner in the cafeteria, staring vacantly at the television, turned to the local news, then the anchorman mentioned something about E.T., which startled me out of my daydream, and a moment later I saw a photograph of me at age 7 flashed on the screen. Oh, Gertrude, "You space cadet," someone called to me. I'd heard teases like that for years and laughed along with the others, but the image that confronted me on the television screen was too startling now to have an effect. It was like seeing a ghost of yourself from an earlier life. I got a sudden rush of nerves and anxiety. I was intensely frightened and wondered if anyone could see me trembling. See, in rehab, you get to the point where you feel very safe and protected, and I was at that point. I'd forgotten as much as I could that I was Drew Barrymore, the celebrity. I was relearning how to be an ordinary, average kid, but when my face came on the screen, all of a sudden, it was as if I was open and vulnerable to the world. For the next few days, though, I talked about that experience, my fright, and my sense of vulnerability, and discovered that being open and vulnerable to the world was an inescapable part of being alive. Somehow that chance encounter with the image of myself on TV became the turning point in my treatment. No longer was I going to run from my fears. Instead, I decided I was going to confront them. As the weeks turned into months, I began earnestly working the program, grappling with the big issues of my life, my relationship with my mother, with my father, and with my sobriety. I began participating in my therapy, revealing my hurts and fears. Most important, I recognized that vulnerability wasn't a sign of weakness, but a part of being human. For the first time since who knew when, I found myself enjoying my age rather than acting it. It was as if I'd made a new friend, me. In the back of her mind, Drew wondered not if she would someday talk about all she'd gone through, but when. She didn't tell anyone of her plan. It was her story, after all. She didn't need anyone's permission to speak, and she felt as if she'd know when the time was right to bring it up. Unfortunately, that seemed to be decided for her 2 weeks into December in a way she never expected. One afternoon, Jade arrived at the hospital to take Drew to a dentist appointment. As she waited beside the outer reception desk for Drew, a father who had told ASAP officials he was interested in admitting his teenage daughter asked Jade what she thought of the program. He had just finished touring the facility with a treatment coordinator who had noted the unusual curiosity with which he studied each patient's face. Jade answered his questions until they seemed to cross an understood line of politeness. He was getting too specific, what one might term downright nosy. Then, without warning, Drew came bounding out, greeting Jade with a hug, and the man with a skeptical nod. His eyes seemed to light up. He tried to strike up a conversation. "Aren't you Drew Barrymore?" he asked. "How is your treatment going?" Alarm bells suddenly went off inside Jade's head. Her piqued suspicion turned into paranoia. Grabbing her daughter's arm, she and Drew sprinted outside to their car, leaving the mysterious gentleman behind. But not for long, though. The tabloids were on the case. It confirmed their worst fears. Reporters continued calling for days. Their hearts sank. The elaborate precautions everyone had taken to keep Drew's treatment out of gossip columns had suddenly been blown, and it didn't take a genius to know that this was going to be exploited for all it was worth. Headlines in the January 3rd, 1989 edition of the National Enquirer printed in glaring yellow letters trumpeted the alarming news. ET star in cocaine and booze clinic at 13. The shocking untold story. No attempt was made to hide the story from Drew, but there was concern over how she would react. However, she had already considered her reaction. I can't even begin to describe how angry I was. Fortunately, though, after so many months of rebuilding myself, I was feeling better, less vulnerable, and more confident. I'd come to terms with a lot of stuff in the hospital, and I guess that made me a stronger person. I felt like one, at least. I might have fallen apart when the story came out, a momentary loss of composure from the shock, but I was able to pick up the pieces and get it together. There were lots of phone calls, hundreds of them, it seemed, where everyone talked about the story. It was dissected to death until it was too boring to think about. My mom was terrific throughout. We cried on each other's shoulder, we talked, we held each other, which shows how far we'd come. But then it was up to me. I'd been through too much to let that trash beat me up. I had to make a decision, a big decision. Was I going to let this horrible press about me go unanswered? Or
was I going to take control of the situation and let people know what happened to me was wrong and that I was trying to do something about it? I wasn't ashamed or embarrassed, weak or injured. I was simply human, a human being whose dignity was being exploited in the worst possible manner. Sometimes it's better not to respond to gossip. Most times, in fact, it's better not to respond. However, I decided this wasn't one of those times. I think it took courage on my part, but I didn't want to be considered another Hollywood tragedy. That's the last thing I am. I'm a success. That's why I decided to tell my story. If I've learned anything, it's always better to tell the truth. And by doing so, maybe it will help other kids not end up like me. And that is the end of chapter one. Next time, we will be starting chapter two, The Inheritance. I will talk to you guys again soon. Later. Okay, guys, if you want to hear more, head over to Cassandra Explains It All, patreon.com, and go ahead and join the Patreon. You can hear the entire book. We are up to chapter five, Growing Pains, right now, and we'll be going through the entire thing. See you there. Later.